Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classic Gaming Brothers. I'm Seth.
And I'm Zach.
And we are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right. We are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right.
That's right. Always classy, sometimes always classic, sometimes classy. Hey, Seth, where are we right now?
Oh, I don't know.
We're at PAX.
Oh, we are at PAX. We're coming live to you from the floor of the BCEC from a video cassette that Zach stashed away in his jacket pocket, and now he's playing the video cassette of a pre-recorded episode through the microphone. And yeah, that would be great if we did that. And by great, I mean a tragedy.
You watch it. I'm gonna do that for this episode only, so the audio quality is absolute garbage.
No, don't do that. I'd yell at you. Also, you'll forget this bit even existed by the time it's time to edit. So we're excited to see different things. We talked about our time in PAX and the exciting booths that I've already forgotten that we're going to see in our previous episode to this, our pre-PAX pod. And look forward to a post-PAX pod sometime after PAX. And possibly look forward to guests that we're already meeting here. This is the past, so who knows? Maybe everyone hates us.
Maybe we did something terrible at PAX, and now we're banned from ever coming back.
That's true. Well, so we're unfortunately not going with three Ryans. We're only going with two Ryans. So that might have caused us to get banned.
Wow. I can't believe we lost a Ryan in the whole time between one episode and the next.
Yeah. We don't know where he is. We've sent the search party out.
Anyway, getting into today's episode, why don't you tell me what you have recently been playing?
So the game that I've recently been playing is a game called Unheard Voices of Crime. It's a game that was released back in March 29th of 2019, developed and published by Next, all capital letters, NEXT Studios. In the game, you play as an acoustic detective. And what is an acoustic detective, you ask? You're a detective who can hear every word at a scene of the crime, but you can't see anything beyond the like little people moving around. So you can see where the people are on the map, but you don't see what the people look like. You just hear their voices. And the way that the game plays is you're looking at like a blueprint of a building, and you play as like a little dude on the blueprint, and you can move this little dude through all the different rooms, but you only have a visual clarity of what is in the current room that you're in, so you can't see what's in other rooms if you can't have like a visual sight to them. And then there are other people moving around the various different rooms, and it's a track, so it's like an audio track that plays, and depending on where you are in the building is what you could hear in the audio track of people talking. And you have to identify who on the map is who. So you have to be like, that's Stan and that's Frank and whatever. And you have to answer some questions. So it may be like, who blew up the police station or something like that. You have to investigate these mysteries as they unfold using only hearing what's going on and making some deduction based on the conversations people are having, because maybe somebody refers to somebody only as a nickname, and they maybe you have to kind of deduce who that person actually is. But it's a fun game, Unheard Voices of Crime. I played it back when it came out. I played a couple hours of it and then decided recently that I was gonna continue playing it because I wanted to continue to finish it. So I'm on the fourth out of the fifth mission. There is also DLC that you can download as well if you really enjoy the game. It's a fun little game where you get to be a detective, but only with your ears.
Cool. That sounds a lot of fun.
What, Zach, have you been playing?
Seth, recently I've been playing Star Wars Dark Forces Remaster. Released February 28th of 2024 by Night Dive Studio, Dark Forces Remaster is, in fact, as the name implies, a full remaster of the original Dark Forces, which originally came out in 1995. Dark Forces is a great game. For those who don't know or haven't heard us previously talk about it, which we have talked about Dark Forces a lot, it plays a lot like Doom, but if you could jump and look around, which you can't do in Doom very well. In Dark Forces Remaster, it's equally as fun as the original Dark Forces, but it also has some brand new features. The game boasts 4K 120 frames per second visuals, has new high quality textures to properly scale the game to higher resolutions, and another change is that the cutscenes have reworked animations and CGI. They still keep the kind of clunky feeling, I would say, of the original cutscenes, but they definitely brush them up to make them look a lot nicer, especially when you have the game playing on like your 4K monitor. One downside, in my opinion, is the price. The game is currently for sale for $29.99, which is a bit steep, if you ask me personally, for a game that is effectively nearly 30 years old. Now, I understand that Night Dive did a lot of work to get this game to run as well as it does, and some of the work they did is incredibly impressive. For one thing, to get the high-quality textures, they couldn't just go to like a source and find like high quality textures. They had to manually make the high quality textures by hand. So every texture in the game has been manually redrawn to be higher quality, which meant they had to look at like pixelated blasters from Dark Forces from 1995 and being like, okay, let's make this look better when you have it in a high scale, a higher resolution. So I understand Night Dive does a lot of work in getting their remasters to look as well as they do. However, as another point, most of Night Dive's remasters have a pretty standard price scheme. Power Slave Exhumed, Rise of the Triad Ludicrous Edition, and Turok, which are all very well done, well-crafted remasters, all retailed for $19.99. $29.99 for Dark Forces Remaster is only $10 less than the 2023 remake of System Shock, which was a full-fledged remake from the ground up. So I'm not saying they didn't put the same amount of care and work that they do for like a game like System Shock. I'm not saying they didn't put that type of work into Dark Forces Remaster. I'm just saying it's a little rough in terms of looking at a price of like $39.99 for what is effectively an entirely brand new game and $29.99 for a game that I already owned two copies of. Now, that's just my personal opinion. I do know that Night Dive recently, I believe, was acquired by Atari back in the later part of 2023. So I don't know if this is just on Atari in terms of, you know, they want to maybe go a different direction with these remasters. Maybe they want to sell them for a little higher and produce maybe they are trying to like spread out Night Dive's releases a bit. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing, but that's just my personal opinion. $29.99 for a game that it's very good, but I mean, in my opinion, it could be a 1999 game sort of deal, you know? That being said, though, Dark Forces Remaster is a lot of fun. I would say maybe pick it up when it's on sale. I actually picked up my copy when it was on sale. It was a few dollars off. It was, I believe, $24.99 when I bought it, which I thought was more than reasonable. I do think that they did a good job bringing this game into 2024, into a modern era, very well, and some of the work that they did is very impressive. That being said, again, maybe wait for the sale.
You didn't mention it, but we have to mention it at least once an episode, but it runs pretty well on the Steam Deck.
It runs great on the Steam Deck. I've actually been playing probably majority of it on the Steam Deck. Another fun thing about it is you can toggle between the new high-res textures and the old resolution textures if you want to give yourself a little bit of a headache.
How do you do that on the Steam Deck?
I don't know how you do it on the Steam Deck. It's a button map, oh. So you can probably assign it to us something. Well, today we're going to be talking about a game that was actually recommended to us by one of our listeners. So yeah, this is from our listener, Joe, who commented that we should talk about Blaster Master. To get into memories, I don't have any memories of Blaster Master. So for those who are new to the podcast, Seth and I were a Sega family. We grew up with a Sega Genesis, and I think I first discovered Blaster Master when I was getting into emulation of NES games. I don't think we also ever played Blaster Master 2, which was a Genesis exclusive. I do recognize the artwork, so I definitely think I remember seeing it maybe in video stores, but yeah, I don't remember ever renting it. What is nostalgic though for me, oddly enough, is the theme to Blaster Master, which you would have heard at the beginning of this episode, just before the title sequence. And this is because the AVGN used this song for like one of his really early videos as background music. It's like a scene of him setting up some video game system and it's just playing the Blaster Master theme in the background. And I loved the AVGN growing up. So that's like my memory is listening to that song and not really knowing what it was. And then hearing it one day and being like, ah, oh, yeah, Blaster Master. So Seth, what are your memories of Blaster Master?
Yeah, so I, to Zach's point, we really didn't have Blaster Master while growing up. Sometimes in my head, I say Master Blaster, and I think that's something else.
So Master Blaster is not something, and Math Blasters is something.
Yes,
and
I almost
wrote
something.
This whole episode on Math Blasters.
And Math Blasters we did, in fact, grow up with, and that is a game. But Blaster Master, I do not have that many memories of. One of our listeners, Mike, who is possibly listening to this episode while driving his 18-wheeler in American Truck Simulator, loves Blaster Master to the point where my memories of him are of him wearing Blaster Master shirts and finding Master Blaster Mike merch and games that are getting released at PAX that are like Blaster Master. I remember a PAX where he was very excited to find someone either doing like a homebrew game that was very similar to Blaster Master. I do know that it involves a tank, and it also involves a man piloting that said tank.
Yes.
And sometimes that man comes out of said tank, and sometimes he goes into said tank. And you're like moving the tank around the map, and it's like kind of like a platformer. So that's like what I know just based on it existing in the zeitgeist and me tapping the aether of knowledge that floats around me. But beyond that, it's not like I'm like a Master Blaster fan. Joe and Mike are definitely Blaster Master fans, so this episode is for you and anyone else.
Now, to get into the history, Blaster Master was developed by Sunsoft, and you know what that means? It's time to talk about Sunsoft, because when we mention a company that we've never talked about before, we have to tell you all about that company and its nitty-gritty details. They were originally founded in 1971 in the city of Konin in Aichi Prefecture, Japan. Sunsoft got their start as Sun Electronics Corporation and primarily worked as an electronics vendor and manufacturer. In the later part of the 1970s, the company began to work on video games for the growing arcade market. Their first games would be Block Challenger and Block Perfect, which were released 1 month apart from each other and were clones of the game Breakout. By the 1980s, they had restylized themselves as Sunsoft, and then they would make a shift from working in the arcade to working in the home console market. Some of their earliest games for the Famicom were Super Arabian, Atlantis no Nazo, and Iki. Another game that they developed at this time was Chowakusei Senkei Metafight, which became localized as Blaster Master. Now, the game was developed by Sunsoft employee Kenji Sada, who wrote the code for the game, per an interview with the art and level designer Yoshiaki Iwata. For the website level42.com, the team consisted of one main programmer, one sub-programmer, one lead designer, one character designer, and a sound programmer. And the team also worked part-time, so this was five people working part-time on a game. I'm sure they were very busy. Iwata notes in his interview that beyond the designs, he was also heavily involved in other parts of the game's development, as was the entire staff, as they were a relatively small team, so the entire staff was heavily involved in the game's development and were closely working on it. The design of the game, per Iwata, was based around the idea of 360 degrees of movement that you would be able to accomplish with the main vehicle, which in Blaster Master is called Sophia. He also emphasized that they wanted to really push the Famicom's limits on what it could do, and they did this by creating large bosses. The large bosses that you see in Blaster Master are basically just because they wanted to make the Famicom to do all that it could, and they really wanted to push it. Iwata states that, quote, "The goal was really to try to pull off the best graphics on the NES to date. Simple graphics were more or less the standard on the NES at the time, but I had this firm belief that it was possible to do something better, something prettier," end quote. Kenji Sada would create the game's ability to alternate between two different modes, 2D side-scrolling and top-down. He also came up with the idea that the vehicle would be able to scale walls and ceilings. Part of this influence came from the game Metroid, as they thought it helped to build on a non-linear style of gameplay, something that Metroid has, a non-linear style of gameplay.
Now, usually we split the story aspect of the game away from the history of the game, but the story of Blaster Master did get drastically changed between the Japanese release and the US release, so we'll go over it here. In Japan, the plot of Blaster Master is that the story takes place on the third planet in the Sophia system, in the Epsilon Galaxy. The year is 2052, and the Imvin Dark Star Army has invaded Sophia the Third. You take control of a pilot named Kane Gardner, who controls the Metal Attacker, an all-terrain tank created by the Science Academy of Nora. You're sent into battle to fight the invasion. Man, I want science places to make weapons of destruction.
I mean, isn't that what Lockheed Martin is?
No, they're just a place that makes weapons of destruction.
I mean, you gotta have some knowledge of science to make a jet. Don't tell that to Boeing, though.
The American version is a bit different. In the American version, a man named Jason loses his pet frog, Fred. Fred then grows gigantic after touching something radioactive and falls into a hole in the Earth. Jason goes in to find Fred, and when he does, he discovers a tank called Sophia the Third, which was created to fight mutants. Jason gets into Sophia and goes to find Fred and kills mutants. Hopefully not Morlocks, because they live under the sewers and are also mutants.
I do like the difference, though, between these stories. Like, one is about a hero fighting off an evil army invading a planet, and the other is about a guy who has a pet frog.
I also think it's very, like, Japanese and American culture. I think they kind of correspond with each other, because I feel like with Japanese culture, there's a lot of media that is very much portraying people in an ideal sense. Like, you're like, you have Gundams, you have like heroes, they're like a lot of manga, you know, it represents like an ideal state, where in the American culture, media tends to try to connect with people, and like where they try to be like Spider-Man's a high schooler with problems and also is a superhero kind of thing. I feel like now, more recently, I think that global media is tending to be kind of like a more Americanized type of cultural spin on it, but I don't know if it necessarily made sense, but I think it aligned with what was going on in the world. This change in story wasn't just something you would read in the instruction booklet. The entire game actually had an opening sequence redesigned to match this new story. One proposed potential reason for the change is because of it being anime-like. And at the time, anime wasn't very popular in the United States, and the localization team may have felt it hard to properly market the game, which is kind of like what I've already talked a little bit about. And as pointed out in an article on the website thegamefanatics.com, changes to Famicom games to the US market were not uncommon, as religious and risque imagery was often changed, which we talked about in previous episodes, where sometimes they would take crosses out and other various things in the media. And it wasn't necessarily us doing it, it was the Japanese companies doing it before they got to us, or the American versions of the Japanese company, so like Nintendo of America. This story, the one specifically about Jason and Fred, wouldn't just remain in the game, it would go to the world of novelizations. Peter Larangus, under the pen name FX9, adapted the story of Blaster Master into a novelization that was published by Scholastic Book. The book was published along with others in a series called Worlds of Power, which also had adaptations of Ninja Gaiden and Infiltrator. As the book was written for kids, they cut out all the violence of all of these games.
Yeah, which Infiltrator is about like an Apache helicopter. We had that game.
Yeah, Blaster Master was about a tank. Infiltrator was about an Apache helicopter, and Ninja Gaiden about a ninja. So they cut out the violence, which I would say big portion of the game, but it's got to be for kids. You haven't read any of these Scholastic books, have you?
No, I really want to pick some up. If we see them at like Retro World or Too Many Games, I'm 100% buying them.
Now, according to an article on 1UP.com by Sean Strzok and Scott Sharkey, the Blaster Master book was the most challenging title for Larangus to write, as Blaster Master as a game doesn't feature a middle plot. That meant that Larangus had to essentially come up with his own details to flesh out the story that tied into the beginning and the end. Instead of being upset that some guy randomly came up with a story, Sunsoft would actually go to the novelization and use those elements of Larangus' story for the sequel, Blaster Master Blasting Again, for the PlayStation 1.
Now, Blaster Master, in terms of its gameplay, as we alluded to, has a mix of styles. A portion of the game is played in a 2D perspective where you control the tank Sophia, and another portion is controlled where you have a top-down view of Jason as you navigate mazes and fight enemies. The game is considered non-linear, in that you often have to go back to earlier levels in the game to proceed through the main objective. In each level, your goal is to destroy mutants and kill the mutant boss. While inside Sophia, you are able to control a cannon that can shoot either up, right, or left. It depends on your orientation in Sophia. Sophia is able to scale walls and go upside down on ceilings, which is useful. And when you leave the tank, you will enter a top-down mode and Jason can shoot in any direction. There are also various power-ups that can be collected for both Sophia and Jason, such as grenades, homing missiles, a thunder attack, etc. A fun fact is that there is a glitch in the game that some critics have even said is probably the most useful glitch in the game because it's sometimes necessary to beat some of the harder underbosses. It's a glitch where if you throw a grenade and the grenade explodes and you pause the game on the explosion, everything in the game will freeze except for the damage being done by the grenade. So the grenade will just have a frozen explosion on the boss that just does all the damage for you. And apparently, you can just cheese a couple of the bosses this way. At least four of the bosses in the game can be beaten using the grenade glitch. And you know what? I love that. I love games that have a fatal flaw that becomes a feature.
Right. Yeah.
Mega Man has something similar. Mega Man has a glitch that's like a pause glitch where if you pause it in a certain way, you can like chain attacks so that they like build upon each other. It's just stuff like that. I think it's great.
They're essentially these exploits that get discovered and then told at recess and get exploited throughout the entire school system.
100%. Like it's like someone, imagine like you're at recess, like you said, and your friend comes up to you and they're like, oh, I'm having a tough time trying to beat that boss in Blaster Master. You know, I keep restarting the game and going through it and I keep dying, and you're like, well, guess what, save your grenades and just press pause.
Now, in regards to what happened when it came out, Blaster Master scored fairly well when it came to reviews. All Game gave it a 4.5 out of 5 star, Famitsu gave it 32 out of 40, and Nintendo Life ranked it as 9 out of 10 stars. It was featured in a 1988 buyer's guide from the publication Game Players as a truly awesome game. Positive reviews have primarily focused on variety of gameplay, the fast-paced nature of the action, and the non-linear structure. There has also been a focus on the graphics and music for the games, which have received positive criticism. One point of contention in some reviews, such as IGN review from Levi Buchanan, was the lack of a save function. So you would have to beat the game in one sitting, or I guess you could leave it on overnight while paused, which was certainly a tactic back then.
That's how Mike Case played Final Fantasy.
That's right. Another criticism came in a 1993 issue of Nintendo Power, which suggests the game may have not sold well due to lack of a licensed property, since it was Blaster Master and wasn't like Mario Blaster Master.
So yeah, we weren't able to find exact figures on Blaster Master in terms of its sales data. However, that Nintendo Power magazine from 1993 specifically put Blaster Master in like underperforming games reviews. So it definitely wasn't selling well enough to get into like a top spot. It was considered an underperforming game in the 90s, and you know, came out in the 80s.
Still got sequels.
It sure did.
They made enough money somewhere. In the years since, Blaster Master continues receiving positive reviews, being ranked on IGN's top 100 NES games at 22 and number 11 on 1UP.com's list of top 25 NES games.
In terms of its legacy, Blaster Master really does survive. A sequel, Blaster Master 2, was released in 1993 for the Sega Genesis, exclusively for the Sega Genesis, I should add. Another sequel, Blaster Master Enemy Below, came out in 2000 for the Game Boy Color. Another sequel, Blaster Master Blasting Again, came out in 2000, and another sequel, Blaster Master Blasting Again, came out on the PS1 in 2000, and was the first game in Japan to get the name Blaster Master, because all the other games that had been released in the series had been called Meta Fight. So this is the first game in Japan to actually adapt the Americanized version of the story and to get the name change to Blaster Master. And a reboot of the game was made in 2010 called Blaster Master Overdrive, which came out for the Wii. In the years since, Sunsoft has stepped away from developing Blaster Master games, and the IP is now with a company called Inti Creates, who knows, Seth and I might be at their booth right now as you listen to this episode, because they are going to be at PAX. Inti Create created Blaster Master Zero and Blaster Master Zero 2, and they're working on Blaster Master Zero 3. These are retro-style platformers based on the original game. A fun fact is that the Zero series combines the plots of the American game with the original Japanese version of Meta Fight and incorporates elements from Peter Larangus's Worlds of Power book. So, you know what? Maybe if I see Inti Creates, I'll pick up a copy of Blaster Master Zero.
Maybe you will.
Anyway, that will do it for our episode. I want to thank Joe for recommending Blaster Master, and we're going to get into the Retro Rewind. Seth, why don't you go first? Because I think it's important that you go first.
Zach had me play Robo Warrior for the NES. Robo Warrior came out in 1987 in Japan as a spin-off of Bomberman called Bomber King and released under the name Robo Warrior in North America and Europe in 1989. Now, this game, Robo Warrior, was developed by Hudson Soft and Acom. However, it's really fitting that Zach gave me this game because the sequel to Bomber King in Japan came out on the Game Boy in North America as Blaster Master Jr., developed by Sunsoft. So Bomberman and Blaster Master have nothing to do with each other in continuity, except that Bomberman came first, Robo Warrior was a spin-off of Bomberman, then Robo Warrior had a Game Boy sequel called Blaster Master Jr., which was related to Blaster Master. So I would say Bomberman and Blaster Master Jr. are second cousins. Within Robo Warrior, there are 27 levels in the game, and you must traverse various types of level formats. There, you definitely feel the Bomberman vibe off the game. There's lots of bombs to be used. You're moving around from a perspective where it's a top-down perspective, and you could go through and you drop the bombs, clear areas. There's different level formats, so like where some levels might be mazes and some levels may be like dark and you may need a lantern or something like that to see the way. The player character that you are playing as is Zed, which stands for Z-type Earth Defense, and the game takes some gameplay from previous games that Hudson Soft developed, namely Bomberman. It's a fun game, definitely worth a pickup. It provides some challenging parts, but they're not like challenging to the point of defeatism. They're challenging like a good classic challenging game. It's a gem of a game, Robo Warrior, and probably one of the better games on the NES. I appreciate Zach for giving me this game and not trash, which is what he usually gives me. So thanks, Zach, for that. And next week, Zach, you can play In the Hunt for the PlayStation, which is a submarine game, which is on brand because...
Yeah, so Seth had me play Silent Steel, which originally came out in 1995 and was developed by Tsunami Games. Seth actually talked about Silent Steel as I recently played a while ago. I don't remember when, and I'm too lazy to look it up. Seth, though, gave me Silent Steel. For those who don't know, Silent Steel is a full motion video game where you play as a captain on board a submarine who gets news that there is an enemy submarine that is nearby. That's all that I'm going to reveal. There's more to the game, like things happen beyond this. But you do have multiple options on how you proceed with this news. You also have options on how you treat the crew. You have options on who to trust. Because the entire game is, in fact, a movie, like a half hour long movie that you are watching and choosing the dialogue for your character. And depending on the dialogue that you choose, the actions that you take have consequences. It's kind of a neat idea. So a couple of games, I believe, did this back then. I can't name them off the top of my head, but I am aware that Silent Steel wasn't the only game to have this type of mechanic. In fact, there are some games on the Sega CD, like Sewer Shark and stuff, that have kind of a similar vibe to them, except it's instead of choosing dialogue, you're like controlling like direction that a character goes. But in any case, I think this is a style of game that I really wish was more embraced by people. I want more games to have like Bandersnatch style of a gameplay mechanic, like Netflix tried to do with Bandersnatch, where you have like you just choose the dialogue options and you like you choose the dialogue options, you choose what happens, you choose where the person's gonna go. More games need to do this, let me tell you. I want more movies to do this. I want Dune Part 3 to be a Silent Steel game. In any case, Silent Steel is a fun little game. It's a fun little kind of look back into the 90s. I will say that the Windows version is heavily compressed, so if you really like watching videos at like 240p, certainly try to play the Windows version. But if not, you can hunt down the DVD copy, which currently is going for like $100 on eBay. I'm sure it looks slightly better in DVD quality. That being said, does it hold up? Sure. Next week, Seth, you can play Captain Commando for the Super Nintendo.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Classic Gaming Brothers. If you have any thoughts on this episode, you want to tell us anything about it, send us an email to classicgamingbrothers@gmail.com. We're also available on Facebook, Classic Gaming Brothers, Instagram, Classic Gaming Brothers, XCG Brothers Pod, Blue Sky CG Brothers Pod, or Threads, Classic Gaming Brothers. We're available on YouTube now, thanks to YouTube Music's podcast functionality, so be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube and give our podcast a listen there. You can also find us on other podcasting applications, be it Podbean or iHeartRadio or iTunes or Spotify. Anywhere you listen to podcasts, we're there. In fact, Seth and I have outlasted some podcasting applications, and that's a fun fact. For anyone who is interested in buying any merch, we have some t-shirts available on our website, classicgamingbrothers.com. Now, thank you everyone for listening. And if you met us at PAX, this little section's for you. It's nice to meet you. Anyway, Seth, besides that, anything else that I forgot about?
Don't play games like my brother.
And don't play games like my brother.
I've been Seth.
And I've been Zach.
And we've been the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right.